Right then, everybody, it's a marvellous day here in North Yorkshire. The fields swaying in the breeze over in the distant corner there of my estate. The beep of my phone going off. Some good news is happening. Nothing but good news this week. This fortnight, in fact. And we're here to bring you more good news in the shape of the Linux Voice podcast, Series 5, Episode 10. My name's Andrew Gregory.
My name's Ben Everard.
And my name's Graham ASMR Morrison.
And sadly lacking is Mike Saunders, because he's not here. But this gives us a golden opportunity to tell everybody what we really think of his rubbish book. Possibly the worst book ever, with the exception of that one that Ben did about the Raspberry Pi.
Yeah.
So if you really want a really rubbish book about programming, I would definitely recommend not buying the Haynes Guide to Programming. Is that what it's called?
Python, I think.
Haynes Guide to
I
Python.
I think it was coding.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Oh well. Anyway, whatever it's called, it's rubbish. Don't buy it. Yes. So with that Gove-like stab in the back, we've got news still to come. We have our discoveries. We don't have any neurons actually, because we've got no mind.
Actually, somebody sent a neuron and CC'd me. So I
yes!
I do have a neuron.
Brilliant. Also, the system works.
Also, he sent it to Mike at linuxvoice.com, and Mike told us this week that he's no longer using Mike at linuxvoice.com.
But we can't have neurons, so I've deleted the section in the podcast notes where we do neurons.
And do we or do we not have a voice of the masses? If we do have a voice of the masses will be a smaller masses than usual. There'll be roughly three people. So you'll find out when we get there. We're just making things up as we go along, really, improvising like jazz. If you like the sound of this, but in a more structured manner, more of a classical jazz than a freeform, you can buy Linux Magazine now in its illustrious 200th issue, and featuring a DVD with the complete archive of Linux Voice, all 32 issues presented DRM-free for your perusal. That alone is worth the cover price, and there's also a really, really like in-depth, thought-provoking article about the GPL with an interview by interview from Eben Moglen, who was one of the lawyers who was involved in drawing up the GPL, and that, you know, that alone is also worth the cover price. So buy it twice. And now here's Ben with the news.
The news, right, this fortnight, there's been a lot of news this fortnight. We have to filter and sift through to find out the open source related bits. Let's start with some Raspberry Pi related news. And that's that there's now malware targeting the Raspberry Pi, which on the one hand sounds like quite bad news. It's obviously not good that there is this malware out there, but on the other hand, it's kind of a milestone in every bit of technology that someone abuses it in this way. It's quite exciting in its own slightly perverse manner.
That's really good news.
you mean because there's so many people now using Raspberry Pi it's worth targeting?
Yeah. So this malware sort of tries to break into a Raspberry Pi and use it to mine Bitcoins. Now, if you imagine how many Raspberry Pis there have to be out there to be worth trying to mine Bitcoins on.
Yeah.
But I guess we know how many Raspberry Pis are out there. Is it 5 million or 6 million? And I bet most of them are running an old version of Raspbian, because they'll have been installed and then put into their weather center or robot controller or whatever. So there's probably a good range of soft targets out there for the 0.00000001 of a Bitcoin you're going to get out of it.
Yeah, maybe.
I mean, they might even break even, these attackers. Who knows?
Yeah. I mean, it's obviously the way the world's going, really. Malware's a growing problem, and the more users are of a platform, the more issues you're going to have. I know when we, when I ran a SSH honeypot, which is basically just a server thing that sits on the internet, waits for people to try and log in, lets them, and just sees what they do in a controlled sort of sandboxed environment. The Pi and Raspberry login, the default login of Raspberry Pi, was by far and away the most popular popular way of trying to break into it, or one of the most popular, actually, maybe not the most popular. But yeah, it is an issue. Usual Linux security tips apply: block and open ports, keep your software updated, and generally you should be okay.
So popular as in that's what attackers were trying out on on our open ports?
Yeah, yeah. If you leave port 22 open, which is the SSH port, on any server, it just gets hammered by people trying to log in. And they don't try that hard. They'll typically try a list of like maybe 10 common usernames and passwords. And one of them is Pi and Raspberry. And I think that was tried within about 8 hours of me attaching this to the network and not advertising anywhere, not tying it to a domain name or anything like that. It's just the entire internet is constantly being scanned by these things.
It makes a lot of sense. I mean, for those early years with the Raspberry Pi, I mean, I don't think SSH was installed by default as I remember it. But for a while, SSH was installed and running, wasn't it? And so if it was the other side of a firewall and you plugged a Raspberry Pi into the internet, that, you know, lots of us don't bother changing the password on that when you think it's safe, but you kind of forget about them. I've lost count of the... I was just thinking of the Raspberry Pis I might have running. I haven't got that many, but is it 3 and is it 4? Are they all, you know, safe?
Yeah, it's not like when you had physical servers going and you could do the eject command for the CD to pop out so you could find them easily.
Yeah.
With Raspberry Pis, it's easy to lose them. Yeah, I was actually just trying to remember if I've still got one running on us. In fact, it's the honeypot. It might actually still be running.
Yeah.
I think I knocked a cable out of it a few months ago. But
is that how British Airways went down? Was it you knocking a cable out of your Raspberry Pi?
It wasn't me, but I suspect someone may have done. Actually, I have no idea what happened. Right, should we move on with the news? More good news. Yeah, good news. Why not? Canonical is working with GNOME to improve high DPI support in GNOME. So obviously this follows on from the news that Canonical is stopping work on Unity and will be switching over to GNOME with the next release. And there's sort of been a lot of talk about, you know, whether or not they're just going to use GNOME, whether or not there's going to be a collaboration of development and all that sort of thing. I think it's quite a really positive sign that we're seeing that it's actually a collaborative effort to make GNOME better.
Yeah, that does sound good. I know nothing about this, but I remember the Hacker News Q&A session or the Hacker News kind of feedback thread from in a couple of months ago. The high DPI support was one of the most requested features or the most problematic paper cuts that came up. If it wasn't top of the list, it must have been second or third. It is an issue. We've talked about it many times over like 4 years since these high DPI screens became increasingly common. And slowly, I know all the desktop environments are kind of accommodating high DPI screens, but it's too slow.
What counts as high DPI?
I don't know. That's a good question. I suppose something when you're getting into the realm where you're no longer really, I think anything that needs and kind of downscaling. So if you've got an 11-point font, if you need to run fonts at like 20, size 20, to be able to see them as normal size on your screen, I think then you're running on a high DPI screen.
You see, the reason I asked is because I'm running a 4K laptop monitor.
Yeah.
And I've never even noticed any issue. Does that count as high DPI or is that still not enough?
How big's the screen? What, 17?
Maybe.
15?
No, probably 13, 14 inches.
Oh, I'd say that's definitely high DPI. I mean, I don't know how many pixels per inch, how many dots per inch that would be.
I don't know, it's going to take me a while to count them.
Yeah, but I mean, Unity works okay with high DPI. It worked better than most desktops. And I mean, to get it to work on KDE, I had to do quite a bit of messing about to get high DPI to work. There's a slider now in Plasma that works quite well, but it's still not unified across all kinds of applications, whether they use GDK or whether they're just simple, cute applications. And there's just no unification between any of the ways that different toolkits or APIs use, configure themselves for DPI, high DPI, or any DPI.
Yeah, the only issue I've had was with some sort of weird old Java programs, but everything else has just worked. Yeah, hopefully that's the way it will go on GNOME soon.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, next up in our list of news is that the both Inkscape and GNOME are moving to GitLab. Well, at least Inkscape have confirmed, and GNOME are inquiring about the possibilities, having looked at all the options and decided GitLab's the best. So I think this is it's quite interesting for me, particularly that they haven't moved to GitHub, which appears to be the standard for almost every open source thing these days. And they, both those projects have looked at them and said, actually, free software in our hosting provider is important to us, and therefore we're going with GitLab, because GitHub obviously is proprietary on the back end. Whereas GitLab has, it does have some closed source components, but that's in the enterprise version. The standard community version is completely open source. Anyone can download it, run it, etc.
That's
cool. I think it's really good. I think it's really good to see two really high profile projects set, sort of saying, you know, there's a line in the sand here.
Yeah.
We're
yeah.
open source. We expect our hosting providers to be.
Have you used it, Ben? How does it compare to GitHub?
I've used GitLab far more than I've used GitHub, to be honest.
Because I've used GitHub a lot, but I've not used GitLab. So it'd be not, there are, I know that I use Bitbucket as well, and I know Bitbucket kind of it apes many of the same features and user interface tricks that GitLab uses and GitHub uses, but it feels, you know, it's two or three generations behind in terms of its usability and smoothness.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things. I mean, GitLab's always worked for me. I'm sure there are some things that some people would come in and say, you know, it doesn't do this or it doesn't do that, but I haven't hit them. The search feature's a bit rubbish, to be honest. But that's not a huge issue generally. It just works for me.
I should try it. Yeah, one of the reasons I use Bitbucket, incidentally, is to hold all my my encrypted passwords. They're encrypted with my GNU PG keychain, but I'm not terribly comfortable with their names being visible. Now, I could create random hashes, but the names of those keys are kind of useful for me to know which login details for each site.
So you have private repositories in Git in Bitbucket.
Yeah.
Okay.
It works really well with pass on the command line, which you can get to sync automatically with Git.
Okay.
It's a really nice system.
You can get private repositories in GitLab as well, can't you?
Oh, that's good. I should try it. Right.
I think so. I've not tried. We use a self-hosted one at work, and that's the only one I'm familiar with, really.
Right. I'll have to give it a go, but yeah, it's good news.
Yeah. Right. Should we move on to government surveillance news?
Always a perennial favourite.
Let's start with British government surveillance news. And this is that in what was, I didn't check, it was definitely a first act, but it was about rare. After essentially losing an election, Theresa May decided that she would use her minority failed government thingy to try and force through her snoopers charter that she's been banging on about for years. So, yeah, apparently even losing her majority in the House of Commons won't kill this snoopers charter.
Yeah, and it's very difficult it's very difficult. Like, we've spoken about this before as well, and I'm sure I'm so opposed to what it is that she's proposing for a variety of reasons that I'm sure we've spoken about and bored everyone to tears with. But, and I hate to bring up the terrorist attack that happened in London a couple of weeks ago, but there are so many other ways, you know, the discussions prior to the election of how the resources of the police were used and whether they still have enough resources to chase leads. People that did those atrocities were known to the police, you know. It's nothing to do with whether they were using WhatsApp, which incidentally all the MPs are using to discuss their plots and everything in the background. It's just, what is going on with Theresa May and this fascination with our privacy?
Yeah, I mean, it's been pretty well documented, even by fairly high levels of law enforcement, that, you know, they wouldn't have prevented these attacks. This wasn't a failure of intelligence. These are other issues. One of which is a massive cut in police numbers and other things going on as well.
I think you've hit the nail on the head there, Ben, because it's the psychology is that you have to be seen to be tough on crime. And if criminals use encryption, therefore you'd be tough on encryption. And that deflects attention from the fact that you made 30,000 police officers redundant. It doesn't matter that the bottleneck in intelligence isn't gathering data, it's sifting it. It's following up on leads. If you're seen to be gathering more data, you're doing more, you're doing something about the problem. I think it's just playing to the gallery rather than actually trying to keep people safe.
Yeah, I think the issue at this point seemed like she was just trying to sneak it through while everyone was focused on the election fallout, but I don't think that's going to happen anymore. And hopefully...
Well, Jenny, I think in terms of the British public, I think it is relatively snuck through. Everything that isn't either institutionalized homophobia or Brexit is going to be secondary, because those are the two massive issues that are going to dominate UK politics in the next however long. I mean, you can a massive infringement of people's civil liberties is a very poor second to those two headliners.
Yeah, and as a sort of corollary to that, though, is that no one's going to waste any political capital pushing them through.
But nobody ever did. All those petitions, the millions of people and everything that's been done to try and oppose everything that she's ever said.
But it would take such a tiny number of MPs now to stop this going through.
Yeah.
Well, maybe that's a new strategy.
Maybe Lord Buckethead will save us.
Yes. A coalition of Lord Buckethead and Mr. Fishfinger.
If anybody's listening and they have some good suggestions of what we can actually do to make a difference, to change this kind of policy, I'd love to hear it, because I feel so, what's the word? Impotent, basically.
Ennui.
Right, should we move across the pond for American government surveillance news?
What, they're no longer sending their chief spy over here?
Well, apparently that was all fake news anyway. Right, the particular news from the other side of the pond that I'm referring to is the fact that the FBI managed to find a leaker based on images embedded in a web page, or images in a web page, that were scanned from printouts that contained secret dots on them in sort of light yellow on white, so barely visible, that reported the serial number of the printer that did the printing and the time that it was printed and all that sort of thing. And they allowed the feds to trace the person who leaked the documents.
Yeah. I did read... I think this is an important point. It's worth discussing. I think those those things have been known about for quite some time, so it's good that it gets publicity. I mean, I think the EFF's original document was started a couple of years ago that lists the printers that do this. But I did remember reading that I think she was caught because she used work email or something like that to send the document and not necessarily through this method. But also, I checked my printer. My printer's quite an old laser printer and it does create these yellow dots. And many companies, my printer is a Ricoh printer that actually was given to me when it was no longer supported by Windows. It works perfectly well in Linux. The Ricoh and lots of those companies stopped generating this according to the EFF, and it's highly likely that this encoded information has gone instead into the dithering algorithm used to do things.
Really?
So it's not even something that you'll ever pick up on, obviously.
Wow, yeah, that's mad.
Yeah.
Bringing into dithering.
There's lots of discussion as to whether it's actually used and how useful it might be. But, I mean, that's the same with dithering. If you're printing text, there's very little dithering. But it probably then only takes, you know, over the course of a page. And these dots on your printer, of course, if your printer is printing, it's capable of printing 600 or 1200 dots per inch, then they're not visible. You know, and if you're talking about a slight warping in the way that text is printed that can be decoded, you know, with some OCR through Google or through whatever code name the FBI has for its scanning program, then, you know, there's nothing we can do.
I think I've escaped this problem on my printer by injecting, like, off-brand ink so many times into the cartridge that it just smudges a barely legible scroll out coming out. So, I doubt anyone's going to get anything from the dithering in that.
What are you printing out anyway?
You know, things.
Yeah, it's a pity that this leaked document was. Why didn't someone transcribe it rather than, you know, doing an image of the actual scanned copy of the document, which seems pretty bad journalism to me.
Yeah. I mean, you kind of think of it as a sort of safe way of breaking the digital chain, but it's not.
Yeah. It's worth thinking about. It's worth thinking about how we're spied at every single corner of everything that we do. Well, at least the data is generated. Future generations, in like 10,000 years, when we have quantum computers in a speck of dust, and they're rifling through all this information that's been gathered, they'll recreate our lives in virtual reality for other people to experience. I haven't even had a gin and tonic.
Wasn't that the plot of an episode of Doctor Who, like last week or the week before?
I haven't seen it.
Some aliens recreated a simulation of Earth in perfect detail so they could work out our weak points and how to conquer us.
Cool.
They didn't say that they did it by hijacking government surveillance, but then they didn't say they didn't do it that way either.
Fake news, that's what they do.
Yeah.
they just downloaded Twitter for a day.
Right, that's the news this fortnight.
Oh, cool.
Great stuff.
You're going to do a halfway reminder?
Well, I was going to do a roughly halfway reminder because we've been recording for about half an hour now.
Yeah.
Admittedly, some of that was our nonsense, which is only to be found on the bootleg versions of these podcasts.
But we'll be able to find out who linked it by listening to the dots in the podcast.
But yeah, next, it's roughly the halfway reminder, and now still to come, we've the other half of the podcast, including our finds/discoveries. And a neuron, and quite possibly the voice of the masses, although the masses are only us three.
Okay, so voice of the masses, I asked Darcy, we've all been really busy, and so that's the reason why there's no voice of the masses, and we didn't get much time to ask the IRC channel. When I did ask the IRC channel, most people responded with news stories that we've just mentioned and discussions about the current state of British politics. Where's one? There was one interesting one that I remember reading earlier on as an official excuse from the Conservative Party for the reason why the Queen's speech may be delayed.
Yes. I can't. That was about the availability of calf skin. And
that's right. That's right.
It takes a long time for the ink to dry.
Thanks, Andrew. I can't find it in the list of IRC chatter, but that was it.
You see, I've been wondering, because everywhere I've seen this reported, it said goat skin, but I always thought it was written on calf skin.
Yeah, me too. On vellum.
Yeah.
I didn't look.
Maybe it's an austerity measure they've downgraded to mere goat skin, showing that we're all in this together.
So just one other real find from the IRC channel, James Olympus, it's securityheaders.io, which is a site to check your website for the sensible HTTP headers. It gives you a report of basically how secure your readers are, your users are on your website, according to how you've configured your headers, which is really useful.
So is it for checking browsers or checking a website you're hosting?
It checks the website you're hosting.
Okay.
For vulnerabilities in the browsers of your users that may be taken advantage of. There's a word for that, isn't there? Exploited.
Yes.
Does anyone else want to have a go at finding something?
I've got some finds.
I've got something that's not so much a find as something stupid I did, so I'll let you go first, Andrew.
That's right. Leave the punchline at the end so we can lol at you. My find number one, I've got a recording date for my mastermind appearance. Oh. It's going to be the 14th of July.
Wow. So let me put it in the calendar. All
I have to do is read 67% of my reading list between now and then. And all will be well. Find number two is a story in the Ars Technica about, and this is quite old, but I referred to Abraham Moghlen earlier, and I've been doing a lot of reading around him because of this excellent story in Linux Magazine. The first line of this story on Ars Technica, and I'll make sure that we put a link in the podcast notes. The first line is, "Time is running out to prevent complete totalitarian dictatorship until the end of human civilization," Eben Moghlen, the guardian of the GPL, told Ars in an interview. And I just think, I mean, that shows immense chutzpah to kick off something like that. And it's thousands of words long, and it's intelligent and well thought out and well done, all concerned. Discovery number three, Tesla is about to release a kernel upgrade for the Linux kernel under the GPL. So for all that Tesla is really, really cool, and we know that Elon Musk is cool, and because Mike's not here, we have to bang the Elon Musk drum for him. He's gonna save us all by taking us to Mars. And if he doesn't manage to save us by taking us all to Mars, he'll save us by taking all the right-wing nutjobs to Mars instead. But they've, you know, they're on the verge of contributing to the kernel, which is wonderful, and it will go without fanfare because that's just how the GPL is supposed to work. But the GPL is working, and that's great stuff. And those are my finds.
Awesome. Shall I build the anticipation up for you, Ben, and give my finds now? I haven't got anything massively brilliant, actually. I haven't got... One of the things that came up on Hacker News last week, I think, was a link to an article that supposedly listed what they called ultra-conserved words, words that probably stem from the last ice age that kind of... Indo-Eurasian languages have the same sound for, so things like mum,
cool,
and fire, and ash, and spit, and things like that. Which is the discussion that came about was there's some kind of argument over the validity of the research, but I really love the idea of the fact that these sounds must have survived. There must be the sound for mum or mother, the sound that crosses so many languages. There must be a core set of those ultra-conserved words. And so my find was really a question for the audience was, it seems to me that this is a very similar problem to encryption or decryption, in that you can look for patterns in things that you don't know what it is that you're looking for, you don't know what the clear text is, the plain text is, but you've got the ciphertext. And so you look at all of the ciphertext and try and decode what the original text was. Can that not be used to uncover these ultra conserved words from, you know, the Ice Age that people used? So, you know, for example, the list that they created, there's a list of 24 words. And I think some of them are probably true. And if they are true, they reveal something about the life of those people, the kind of things that they did. For example, the fact that the word fire is so important, or the word ash is so important, is because those words have survived, and because they're short, because they needed to be short, because they were said so often and needed to be understood so easily, and they've survived because they remained important for such a long time. And so in decoding what these words could be, you may inadvertently decode something about the lifestyle or the livelihoods of those people. I don't know, I find the idea really interesting.
Oh yeah, that's better. Yeah, so Don, D-O-N, that's, there's the River Don exists in lots of countries. So there's one in England, Russia, Ukraine, I think there's one in Italy, there's one in Wales, one in Scotland, I think. And it's just, it's proto-Celtic for water. And on the one hand, I think it's absolutely wonderful that there's this pan-European appreciation of the importance of water. But also, I look back to our pre-Iron Age, pre-Stone Age ancestors and think, how lazy of you to call a river the river water. That's appalling.
But maybe that was the only river they knew, so that's the water.
Yeah, Lake Victoria, it sort of spans Tanzania, Uganda, Kenya, and yeah, the places. It's one of the largest lakes in the world, and there's no record of it being called anything other than lake in any language before Europeans arrived. So a lot of places sort of reverted to their sort of pre-colonial names, but there isn't another name.
Like, yeah. I guess if there is only one lake, like if they had loads and loads of little, yeah, similarly sized lakes in that region of Central East Africa, then yeah, that would make sense to call them different names. But if there's only one, yeah. I mean, yeah.
Well, this find led me to a discovery of, I don't know if you've listened to it, the History of English podcast. It's fantastic. It's on episode 94 at the moment, but I'll put the link in the podcast notes. It's basically, it starts at the very beginning of the English language. It tries to decode the beginnings of English and document it in a podcast form throughout up until, well, it's aiming for modern times, but at the moment it's got up to the Lion Kings and the Two Arthurs and sometime back then, but it's really good. It's really been going since 2013. I'd never heard of it before, but it's interesting. It's really interesting if you're into language.
So it's about the history of the language, yeah, not sort of the people.
No, the language, the words okay, that make up English.
And did they speak, is a podcast read out in the language of the period they're talking about?
No. And then, well, I'll go on to my final find. A couple of weeks ago, in fact, I had a dream come true. I saw the Aphex Twin, in London at a field day music festival. It was mind blowing. The last 10 minutes was like 10 minutes of noise, but I won't go on about it. Sheer noise, and it took 2 days for the ringing in my ears to dissipate. But what was interesting was that the schizophrenic light show that accompanied the performance, which was like to 15,000 people in like an aircraft hangar, but right in the middle of London in Victoria Park. The all the images and the effects that were being broadcast across the 12 screens, the software, there's two parts to this. A lot of it featured a load of words randomly sprayed across these screens. And Aphex Twin broadcast this gig live on the internet. And before the gig was broadcast, the portal for this stream had a password field. And so people trying to get access to the feed put in loads of passwords, which was then, all of those passwords are then broadcast through the entire performance on the screen, which is pretty cool. The other thing is that part of those words was the link to the GitHub repo for the software that does all of the projecting and all of the calculations and all of the stuff. So my find is that you can create exactly the same absolutely insane, potentially damaging light show that the Aphex Twin used by going to the GitHub repo, which I'll link to in the notes. It's created by, I think he has somebody who actually, this person's worked with lots of different people who actually create the spectacle, and the software's open source and you can use it yourself, and that's my find.
Shall I read out my shame now?
Is it shameful? I feel I might have. You forgot
to
vote. No,
to be honest. No, not that bad. I feel I may have overhyped it, to be honest. Essentially, I missed out a single flag in a command and it locked me out of one of our production servers. Well, I say it's production server. It was on almost semi-production. Anyway, I forgot the A flag in the user mod command. So I was adding a user to a group, and if you don't put in A, it changes your main group. And this particular user happened to be the only user on that system that had sudo access, and there was no root password. So if you don't have the A flag, it overwrites the wheel group, which takes that user out of the group that has sudo access. So then I was stuck with a machine that had no root password and no users with sudo access. And
so you locked out. You have to log out, I guess.
Yeah, I didn't notice until I'd logged out that's what had happened. So it was the next time I logged in that I realised what I'd done. And,
dangerous, actually, when you say it like that. The fact that you have to add a flag to make something not happen.
Yeah, it's just a bit of one of those moments where you don't really think what's going on, and then it takes you a while to unpick everything. Like, I was an idiot.
I find those commands, actually, I've always found them confusing. The fact that it normally creates a user by default. You know, you have to, if you want to add a group to a user, you have to add flags. Otherwise, it'll create a new user or expect to create a new user. I guess it just reflects the way that people used to be added and groups used to be added.
Yeah. In the end, I was able to, it wasn't too difficult to recover the situation. The server hoster could sort of reboot the server into a Rescue Pro, I think they called it, which essentially booted into a live Linux distro, for want of a better word, could then cheroot into the original file system, run the command properly, reboot into the normal system, and it all worked. But there was a moment of, oh dear, what have I just done?
That wasn't running British Airways services, was it?
Shh. That was what I found out, really, is double check your commands when messing with users.
Cool. Right, thanks. They were our finds. Right, so it's now time for neurons, which, as I said earlier on, somebody did this. Kenny sent Mike and I a neuron to read out. I think he actually told us because he was getting enthusiastic about all this talk of retro computers, and I asked if we could use it as a neuron. And really, it was about MSX. Do you remember? I don't know if you do remember those. I need Mike here, really.
I don't know them.
MSX was it was like a home computer and also a console in the 80s. The interesting thing about MSX, as I remember it, I didn't have an MSX, was that they were powerful for what they did. I think it was in the late 80s, but also the design was, licensed. So a little bit like ARM. So lots of different manufacturers created MSX machines, like Toshiba or whoever those big Japanese companies were at the time. So you could get MSX not only in like home computer form. You've got it as a console as well. And they all kind of worked with one another. So Kenny emailed us to say, being an avid listener of your excellent podcast, I hear much mention of the Commodore Amiga, a tale from the 80s, but I never hear about MSX. MSX was an early attempt at standardization in home computers led by the major Japanese manufacturers and a fresh-faced Microsoft. I bought a Panasonic MSX CF2700 computer in the 80s along with a Ferguson cassette data recorder. I dragged it down from the loft the other day and it still works. I'm trying to get hold of a manual for the tape machine as the audio plugs aren't labeled and I haven't found the time to juggle them around to see if I can get the taped game into load. He once created my own game in BASIC, including sprites and all that. And when it got to the stage when it took over 20 minutes to load by the data recorder one day, it failed to load and continued to fail to load. Thus, my work was lost. That's how things were back in the day. But good shout out to MSX. I had a friend with an MSX, and as I replied to Kenny, we played Nemesis, a Konami arcade game conversion, and I think the MSX version was the best version of that game. But I never played around that much with them. But I think there's still quite a fan base for those things. So thanks, Kenny. If you've got any neurons to share, I guess email them to graham@linuxvoice.com as Mike has taken his email offline.
Right, it's almost 9:30.
I'm starving.
I'm starving as well. If we're going to do a voice of the masses, we should make it very quick. Has anybody got anything drastically important that they want to discuss right now? Oh, hang on, one last thing. Boom. We're going to skip the voice of the masses and move on to one last thing. FOSS Talk Live.
God, that's come up quickly.
Absolutely, it has. So the cream of the UK's podcasting is staying at home that weekend, but we're going to be there is it the Harrison? Is it the same venue?
Yeah, it's the same venue.
Same venue, same town, London town, on the 24th of June. If you don't have tickets already, maybe go along and try and scrounge some from touts because it's going to be sold out. It's just going to be us and the Linux Luddites and some of the Ubuntu podcast and other ne'er-do-wells.
Is there any news on whether or not the Ubuntu podcast have biscuits again?
Laminated show notes.
Oh, wow. Yeah. We need to go one louder than that, don't we?
Who's going to laminate the show notes? If I bring a roll of sticky tape, I can sort of go over the top of all the ones as I scribble on the train on the way down.
Does anyone have access to an overhead projector and we can put the show notes sort of on the wall behind us?
That's actually really quite funny. We should do that.
Hey,
I've got a really bright torch. We can just stick something over the front of it.
Right, so if you are lucky enough to be one of the elite few who has already got their tickets to FOSS Talk Live, we will see you there in that London, and I'm actually very looking forward to this because it's been in my calendar for a long, long time. Wicked mad skills. Is Mike coming?
No, I don't think so. He's never said no, but he's never said yes either. Which is how that's how Mike handles the questions mostly.
Is there any word on whether or not they serve voice beer in the bar still so he can replace him with a suitably German pint?
I don't know. Hard times we'll find in out. Brexit Britain. Maybe not. Maybe it's just London Pride and that's it.
Maybe we can just get a pint of Carling and put a little bit of milk in there.
It would probably improve the flavour.
Anyway, on that thought...
Yeah,
I'll go and get a pizza.
Oh, lovely!
Half a pizza.
Yeah, and we should put up a voice of the masses this week. Look out for it, and we can use that as the basis for one in FOSS Talk Live.
Ah, that's a brilliant idea. That's almost as if we know what we're doing.
Yeah.
Sweet. So wonderful. We'll see you in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Au revoir.
See you.
Cool.
Bye.
Goodbye.